This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. Thanks for voting with your ears. We're happy for your support. The size of our audience, you know, is a measure of our clout in the media. And in a nation where elections are virtually constant, we want to explore the mechanics of voting. What constitutes political clout? In a moment, a Cuban dissident who is using her presence on the internet to attract support, giving her far more political clout than she would have as a lone journalist speaking out in communist Cuba. But here in the United States, we think we know about voting, but maybe we don't. The principle of one person, one vote seems second nature, and yet it was a struggle to even get that in America, which in the original Constitution devised all kinds of formulas to keep ordinary citizens from having their own clear vote in elections. One person, one vote is nowhere in the U.S. Constitution, and it wasn't until the 1960s that the idea began to be articulated as an explicit doctrine governing how we define voting districts, precincts, how states supervise what's called apportionment. Retired Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor remembers that once upon a time, congressional districts were based on some pretty sketchy math.
I came from Green Lake County, Arizona, which never had a population of over 10,000 people. But both Maricopa County, with its 2 million people, and Green Lake County had the same number of members of the House of Representatives in Arizona and the same number of senators.
For Justice Stephen Breyer, when he was a child, the whole idea of voting districts and their political clout seemed more like a team sport.
And when I grew up in San Francisco, I knew perfectly well that the people in Northern California had probably more votes in the legislature than those in Southern California. And I would think that's great.
Both justices were speaking in the documentary One Person, One Vote. The Supreme Court finally set out one person, one vote in a series of decisions known as the apportionment cases. And in 1964, in the case of Reynolds v. Sims, the justices decided that under the Equal Protection Clause, state voting districts have to be equal in population. Equal in population, but what if they're not equal in the number of eligible voters? Well, that's an issue the Supreme Court may take up next week. Richard Pildes, professor of constitutional law at New York University, joins us to talk more about this. Richard Pildes, welcome to the program.
Hi, John. Glad to be back.
So let's talk about this issue that might be before the court. There's some sketchy math in the creation of districts, perhaps in the state of Texas. What would the Supreme Court be looking at here?
Well, there's this fascinating question that the Supreme Court has actually never resolved. The court many years ago decided that there has to be one vote, one person, political equality, which means every election district has to have the same number of people, for example, for Congress within a state. But the question is, what has to be equal? Does it have to be the same number of people in a district, which means you include kids, you include non-citizens, or does it have to be the same number of potential voters in a district, which means only the people who are eligible to vote actually count for these purposes?
Now, why wouldn't the court have almost immediately said, well, it's got to be eligible voters, of course. Why would they have left this unresolved?
Well, that's a great question. I think that the issue is arising now in as strong a form as it is, and that's why there's a petition before the court, because of the dramatic rise of the non-citizen population in recent decades, particularly over the last 15 years. And so for a long time, this baseline, the question of, you know, what is the baseline for equality, didn't really matter all that much, and people didn't have a big incentive to litigate this. So the issue never really came to the court, although some lower courts struggled with it. Now, in places like Texas and Arizona, where you have this, you know, dramatic rise of non-citizen population, the issue is coming to a head. And that's why it's been deferred for all these years, and the pressure now is there to resolve it.
So as we're seeing now, the demography of the border and the immigrant populations in the places that you've cited, Arizona and Texas, may be pushing this. But is there any precedent down through history of people playing games with the numbers in districts on eligible voters? I mean, there certainly was a long time in American history where most people in any district weren't eligible to vote, right?
Right. But once politicians are the ones who have the power to design their own districts, then not surprisingly, you know, there are a lot of political shenanigans that get involved, a lot of self-interest involved. And so the numbers in these districts have been manipulated for many years, or at least, you know, to the extent there aren't legal barriers to manipulating the numbers, politicians will take advantage to the extent they can for their own self-interested reasons.
So, Professor, while you and I can have a discussion of how insane it is for politicians to draw their own districts, from the perspective of the Supreme Court, they view this as a states' rights question, that basically this is the state's domain, and they're loath to interfere in these kinds of matters. How do you think the current Supreme Court views the question of federal intervention in what is essentially a state concern?
Well, let me just say, John, that it's the American people who also seem to be resistant to taking this power out of the hands of politicians. It's not really the Supreme Court, in some sense, that's playing the major role here, because, you know, when voters are asked, do you want to set up independent commissions to do this districting? Sometimes they say yes, but a lot of the time they say no, because they somehow think that, you know, they have more control over the process if it's in the hands of democratically elected officials. Now, I think that's a big mistake. But the Supreme Court has been willing to impose some constraints on this whole process. That's the whole point of one vote, one person, that politicians used to manipulate the number of people in these districts. And the disparity between these districts in the 1960s was enormous, like 50 to 1. You know, one district would have 50 times the number of people of another district. And that's what the Supreme Court was trying to bring a halt to when it established, as a matter of constitutional law, the idea of one vote, one person. Now the question is it political equality about voters, between voters, or is it political equality between all the people who live in a district? And that's a legal question that the courts are going to resolve. They may not resolve it now, but that question will get resolved.
So on the question of whether the Supreme Court will take up this case, would they do it on the – and I guess we're speculating here on some level – would they do it to clarify the 1964 Reynolds versus Sims case, or would they dip into a whole entirely new doctrine of one person, one vote involving eligible voters, essentially create a new path?
Well, I think if they took it, it would be to clarify what Reynolds versus Sims means about one vote, one person. The lower courts have mostly said it means equality between people, not between voters. And so the Supreme Court might not get involved because there's not a lot of disagreement right now among the lower courts. But if the Supreme Court took it, it would be to clarify what did we mean when we said one vote, one person. Although at the time, by the way, they said one man, one vote. But we've come to say one vote, one person.
So finally, what if there's an immigration bill that fundamentally changes the eligibility status of people in counties like this? Does this have to be revisited once again? Because then, based on current Supreme Court decisions, the notion of population and equality will have fundamentally changed once again.
Well, if an immigration bill creates a path to citizenship, then whether the baseline set by the court is citizens or persons, the new bill would just fit into that framework. You know, in other words, there still is a fundamental legal question here. It's a constitutional question. Equality between whom? Equality between those eligible to vote, or equality between everyone who lives in a district, whether they can vote or not? And an immigration bill would only change the numbers of people in those categories, but it wouldn't really change the underlying question of what does political equality apply to under the Constitution for purposes of designing election districts.
Remind me, how many justices need to agree to allow the case to go to the Supreme Court?
Four of the justices have to decide the issues are important enough to warrant the court's consideration. So it's called the rule of four. If four of them vote to hear the case, then the court will hear the case. And then, of course, on the merits, you know, five of them have to agree on an outcome.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think they probably will not take this case because I don't think there's enough disagreement in the lower courts right now. But if a disagreement emerges down the road, then they would certainly take the case.
Richard Pildes, professor of constitutional law at New York University. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.